Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan, come.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker. And today I have John Simpson with me. So let me give a little bit of history and kind of explain why I have him on. John has an MA in clinical and humanistic psychology and also an MA in criminology. And he has worked as a therapist for over 30 years in the Ann Arbor, Michigan area. And he's worked with the forensic population for most of those years. He began his career working with people living on the street who were addicted to drugs and alcohol. And after that, spent some time working at a county jail doing assessment and evaluation for mentally ill offenders. He then moved on to working with at a mental hospital treating adolescents. And in 1994, he began working with individuals who had sexually abused women, men, and children. He has seen more than 1,700 people that have been convicted of sexual assault and has provided risk assessment, sentencing, recommendations, psychological assessments, and sexual offender treatment. He's been a member of the county team deployed for critical incidents in his area, providing services for those who have been affected by trauma, such as plane crashes, fires, shootings, and natural disasters. He's taught some college classes, provided training for probation and parole, and has led numerous workshops for community organizations. So welcome, John, to the program. Thank you so much for being here. Now, to give a little bit of history on John, we met several years ago through our ASEC member association. And so that was while I was becoming a sex therapist and getting to know that association. So it's been nice to kind of meet up with him at several conferences since then. And we tend to kind of spend time together and enjoy each other's company. A big part of that, I think, has to do with the fields that we're in, and also the fact that he was raised Catholic. And so as he's come to some of my presentations on Mormon sexuality, and we've talked a lot just over dinner with other therapists that we've met there as well, it's been an interesting discussion about how religion and, you know, these mental health issues kind of intersect sometimes. So, and having some of his Catholic background, we've had some interesting conversations about the similarities in culture with Mormonism and Catholicism or religion in general when it comes to some of these issues around sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how I came to meet John and asked him to be on this program because I think this is a really important subject. And I've had several questions asked me around this kind of issue that I don't necessarily feel equipped to answer because this is not my area of specialty. So having said all that, what else can you tell us about yourself?
As you said, I've been in the field a very long time. I've seen an awful lot of people. And dealing with offender population is a very unique situation. It's not something I would recommend everybody doing. And it takes a certain amount of empathy that is at times difficult when you're listening to very explicit stories about harm that people create. But we've had a lot of success, and over the years, we've only had a handful of people who have reoffended who's gone through the program. And it's been a very intense program for offenders. They average about a year in the program doing work not only around their own sexual offending, but their sexuality, family relationships, religious organization relationships, work and school. So trying to create a whole well-rounded person coming out of this.
Yeah, for sure. That sounds really intense. So I guess before we get into the program itself, I mean, how do you yourself come to do this work? How did that opportunity arise for you, and how did your interest kind of go in that direction?
In 1994, the state of Michigan offered up a contract for the very first time treating people who have been convicted of sex crimes. It was an open bid process. We put in a bid for it. We were awarded the contract. I've been doing it ever since. It wasn't something that I ever planned on.
Arbor
Psychological, the clinic.
Okay.
And I had been working with a lot of offenders up to that point throughout my career. Have seen a lot of people who were basically antisocial personality disorders. So a lot of heavy crime, a lot of assault of crime. But in 1994, what was known about sex crime compared to what we know today was like being in kindergarten. And today we're maybe in the first year of college.
So fairly new research, fairly new field is in essence, I think, what you're saying. So, well, why don't we start there? I mean, what do we know about sex crime?
What we know about sex crime is it happens everywhere. Doesn't matter your background, doesn't matter your socioeconomic status, doesn't matter your ethnic history. It happens to everybody. Men, women both engage in sex crime. Men engage in sex crime and sexual offending at a much higher rate than women do. It's really testosterone driven in that case. We know that men commit sex crimes for a variety of reasons. One of the big myths out there that is very much perpetrated by the offender or by the victim community is that rape is always about violence. As much as rape is a violent crime, the motivation behind rape oftentimes is not so much about violence as it is about an offender trying to meet their own needs in ways that are inappropriate. They tend to either operate out of their own fantasy world, operate out of past experiences, or operate out of this violent, dominant, controlling aspect. Usually when I describe sex crime for people, I tell people it's like a diamond. When you dig a diamond out of the ground, it doesn't shine. It's basically a clear piece of rock. It's not until you start cutting facets into it that you actually get the brilliance of a diamond. The same thing is true for a sex offender. They don't offend. They don't walk out of the mother's womb going, okay, this person's going to be an offender. There has to be several cuts that happen along the way in order for them to come to this point in their life.
So I think what you're saying then is that obviously there's several factors that need to be in place for somebody to get to the point where they would assault somebody in this way. In other words, maybe we're talking about personality or environmental factors or trauma of themselves. What types of things have you noticed that do play a role in this type of development?
Probably the biggest factor that I've seen over the course of several years is the age of introduction to sexuality. The younger the person is introduced to sexuality, not so much by, visual image, but hands-on experience, we see that they tend to take increasingly larger risks with their sexual behavior as they become older. That sense of excitement that was first there tends to drop, so they're always chasing it. And that tends to get a lot of people into increasingly more risky behavior, more difficult behavior, and for a number of people into abusive behavior as well.
So when you say early experience, are you talking about like a 13-year-old who's starting to become sexual, or are you talking about like a 5 or 6-year-old who's been sexually molested?
We're talking about anywhere from 5, 6 to about 10. And it doesn't necessarily have to be sexual molestation. It can be that maybe they were engaging in sexual experimentation with a peer at that point in time because of something they've witnessed, or it was done to them by somebody who was 1 or 2 years older than them. It's really about just that hands-on sexual experience that happens in that time, whether it is abusive or not.
So let's kind of, I guess, complicate this further in the sense of, I mean, you hear about kids kind of quote-unquote playing doctor, you know, like,
right,
there's this normal kind of trend towards sexual curiosity and body mm-hmm. curiosity and gender curiosity, you know, all these kinds of things that seem to be developmentally appropriate. So how do we know when that line is appropriate versus inappropriate?
I guess when it becomes extremely overtly sexual. So if the 6-year-old is attempting to engage in intercourse or some type of oral sex experience, we generally don't see 6-year-olds do that when they're playing doctor, or, you know, even discovering what sexuality is about. That's a pretty big leap for kids usually. So it's really about the overt behavior rather than the fundamental discovery behavior.
Okay, so in essence, kind of a gauge of how sexualized it is. And as we're talking about this, I'm guessing that these spectrums are hard to define at times. Like what is normal / abnormal is difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I get that question often from parents, like, how do you know my child is rubbing up against something or masturbating, or my child just, you know, kissed his brother's penis or something like that? You know, what did this happen to him? You know, they're all up in a fury about what, you know, where is this coming from? And I think what you're saying is it's very difficult to know if this is just kind of normal curiosity or if it's coming from some type of assault right. or trauma that they have experienced.
Right. There's no way to tell where it comes from completely.
So you mentioned anti-personality or antisocial personality disorder. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how often that is a factor in what we're talking about?
The easy way to describe antisocial personality is the lack of empathy. The individual really doesn't care about anybody else except themselves, getting what they want and need out of life, and use other people for their own expense. How often does this happen in sex crime and with sexual offenders? Probably 30-40% of the time. So it's not an overwhelming thing. It's there. It happens with some regularity, but I wouldn't say it's always there with people.
So 30-40% of the time, there's a diagnosable personality disorder, is what you're saying?
Of some type.
Okay.
Whether it's antisocial or it's some other personality disorder.
Okay. And just to, I mean, I know we're talking kind of to a lay audience. I mean, can you talk a little bit about what a personality disorder is in general and versus other types of mental health diagnoses like depression or anxiety or OCD, for example?
The way to think about personality disorder is really to think about it as a brain structure, not something that happens to people, but something that the people are actually born with, that is biological in nature. The best example of that is when we start talking about psychopathy or people who are diagnosed as psychopaths. Psychopaths have this running trait where they tend to be individuals who have little to no empathy. They use other people. They believe that people are on the planet only for their pleasure. They tend to be very charming individuals, very glib, have very shallow emotion. I've heard them described in a lot of ways as people with dead eyes, as a way of looking at them, because they just don't seem to really be there most of the time, even though they're right in front of you and they're laughing and talking freely, but there's something behind it that seems rather different or cold. That's kind of what a personality disorders like. It's something that's always there. It's something that sits behind. Unlike with depression, which or anxiety, which is something that is always out in the forefront. You're going to see it. When somebody's depressed, it's usually very recognizably that they're depressed. When somebody is anxious, it's very recognizable that they're anxious. It's also one of those things that with both therapy and medication can be very well managed. Personality disorders don't change, whereas depression can come and go. Anxiety can come and go. And that's kind of the difference between kind of the personality disorders and the other type of mental disorders that we see, because we see something that's much more treatable. Personality disorders are very hard to treat. What we usually talk about with personality disorders is management rather than treatment. How do I manage my life? How do I manage this so that I don't harm other people, so I don't harm myself, so that things get done in ways that are appropriate and are somewhat to the societal norm?
Yeah, so one of the things that's very well said. And so one of the things that tends to happen in my experience with personality disorders is that because it is, like you're saying, sitting behind and not necessarily up front, that the person with the personality disorder is not usually the one who's coming in for treatment. In other words, it's not usually likely that they're self-aware enough to even know that they have a personality disorder, whereas somebody who's depressed or anxious kind of understands that there's something going on differently than what they're used to, or they tend to come in quite frequently knowing that they want to see change for their lives.
I would agree with that.
Okay. So, having said that, Is the reason why you have seen so many people with personality disorders, is that in essence they've been brought to you through the criminal system, or are they coming in for self-help themselves?
Offenders don't usually come in for self-help. When you see somebody who's committed these type of offenses, they are usually ordered into treatment. It is a condition of their probation or parole or their sentence of some type, and they are mandated to complete a treatment program. The individuals who come into treatment without mandated usually don't last long in treatment. Best example is I had a man a few years back that came into treatment. He thought that he had problems with being sexually attracted to children. After my initial assessment with him, it was guaranteed he had problems with it. He lasted in treatment all of about 5 sessions, and when things started getting tough and we started really talking about where this attraction comes from, he ended treatment and never returned. So for offenders, it's something that may be hard to give up in some ways, or something they don't want to do, so they're not going to do it unless there is a mandate for it.
Right. So that brings up a whole other issue in my mind anyway, is how many offenders are being caught by the criminal system, right? Because we know, obviously, through our research with many of the victims, that so much of this happens within family systems or friendship circles. And so many of these people are never really turned in due to loyalty or, you know, kind of complicated family variables.
Or whatever variables. Yeah, there's a lot of variables that keep people from being exposed or turned in. It's hard to make an estimate how many people we actually have out there who commit sexual offenses without being caught compared to those that we know of who are actually caught. What we do know is the research is really interesting over the past few years that we've seen about a 60% reduction in sex crime in the United States since 94. It's not widely reported, but we've been continuing to see this decline as we become much more aware, as we do much more prevention work, as we get the word out. And we've seen, at the same time, reporting actually go up about crime as well compared to what we would see, say, back in the 1970s or early 80s.
In other words, it's become safer to report sexual crime if you're a victim. And somehow there's factors in place that are are actually preventing sexual crime to begin with.
Correct.
And so you're saying some of those factors, I mean, do we know what those factors are, or are you theorizing, like, it might be education, it might be, have you even heard of pornography?
We don't know exactly if there's one factor or not to that, or even how many of the factors we're looking at actually make a difference at this point. That research is still ongoing, trying to figure out what are the pieces that are actually working.
Mm-hmm. Because I think there was a study a while ago, like over in Europe somewhere, that the increase of pornography viewing, not that pornography is necessarily a wonderful thing to have around, but I'm just saying the increase of that being available for people who would offend is what they theorized has brought down the number. Is that, have you seen that study or anything like up onto it?
I've seen studies around that issue with the... There's some tricky stuff to some of those studies and whether they're really that accurate or not. I'm not going to put a lot of faith in that at this point. I think it's more that we've done a much better job with creating awareness in the community, in schools, made it much more safer for reporting. We've changed police attitudes a great deal when a report is made. I think just... the fact that sentencing guidelines have gone up so dramatically with this, that we're making an impact in a lot of different areas that are having this trickle-down effect. And whether pornography is part of that or not, it's hard to say. What we do know is that for offenders, pornography is one of those things that we look at, that if they're looking at a lot of pornography, it's what we call a risk factor for an offender. So we don't necessarily want offenders looking at pornography because of that.
So let me tangent with you a little bit there. Let's talk about why would you consider pornography a risk factor? I mean, this is a whole nother podcast, right, that we could do. And I've done several on pornography, you know, because it holds such an interesting place in Mormon culture, you know, as far as we seem to talk about it in very catastrophic ways, you know, that if you're looking at pornography, you know, even once every 6 months that you're somehow addicted. And we use it, the addiction model, quite frequently, you know, in talking about pornography. And I'm usually a critic of that. At the same time, I'm not saying pornography is this wonderful, you know, panacea that we should all just indulge in. So can you give us a little bit of your sense of what are the pros and cons of pornography without us turning it into a whole nother podcast?
Let me just, instead of giving you the pros and cons of pornography, let me talk about it from a very specific, very narrow focus with people who commit sexual offenses. Because it's very different. With the rest of the population, whether they do or do not have problems with viewing pornography, is a whole other discussion. but with offenders...
Yeah, so we're keeping it to offenders, yes.
What it does
is it drives... Thank you for reeling me back in.
Yep. What pornography does for offenders is it drives fantasy. And with offenders, what they will do is they will look at things that drive their fantasy or enhance their fantasy. So if I'm a sadist and I'm an individual who is looking at tying people up, whipping them, creating pain, choking them to death, reviving them, etc., which is what sadism is all about, I'm probably going to be looking at increasingly more violent types of pornography that involve those type of imagery. This is going to feed my fantasy. Then I'm going to start thinking, well, I can do that. And then I start to go out and look for that type of behavior for myself in order to have that experience. That becomes very dangerous for the offender because the more they view that, the more they start rehearsing that fantasy in their own head.
So what makes that different from people who are just consensually into kink? Is it just the fact that they're offenders to begin with, that there's that propensity for being an offender?
There's a difference between kink and sadism.
Expound on that, please.
The easy way to say that is kink is consensual. It's something that everybody agrees to. They know what they're doing. There's safety measures in place. The sadist doesn't want any of that. The sadist wants to inflict as much pain as possible on the individual, non-consensually, for his own sexual excitement. So if in the process of that, the sadist happens to murder somebody, then so be it. It's just part of the sexual act at that point. Kink, you're not going to be murdering anybody. You've gone way over a line by that point in time, probably several lines by that point
right,
in time.
Right.
So it really, the way to look at it is consensual versus non-consensual. And kink, no matter what you look at it, there's always a consensual component to it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Okay, so you started kind of by talking about this program that you have developed, I'm guessing through your clinic, maybe with partners or whatever. Can you start kind of educating us about that? And what is it that helps people who are offenders, I guess, turn that around if possible? Is it possible? What are the, you're saying that there's quite a bit of success that you've had. Can you talk about what success looks like, et cetera?
Okay. The very first thing is probably the most difficult thing for people to think of when they think of people who have committed sexual offenses against others, is when somebody walks into the office who has been convicted of this type of crime, is to provide them with respect. Treat them as a human being first. Be courteous to them. Have empathy for what they're going through. As a treatment provider, that becomes essential to recovery for the client. Then what you have to get into is having the offender take responsibility for their behaviors. Admit to the crime, admit fully to the crime, not just say, yes, I did it, but be able to tell, to say exactly what it is they did. What I've done for a number of years is I have offenders write a story of their offense, and I have them write it in a way that's kind of a little bit different than a lot of people have ever done this, is I have them start with a significant event in their life and tell me everything that happened from that significant event all the way through their crime. And I want that significant event to be something that happened no more than 5 years previous to the crime. Because what we're looking at is all of the other factors that led them to that crime, that led them to think that committing a sexual offense behavior against another person was appropriate, was right, was whatever it happened to have been in their brain. Because we need to figure that out. Without figuring out what those things are, there's no way to create a sense of safety for the community or for the offender. We have to figure out what those needs are for the offender so that we can figure out what are appropriate ways for those needs to be met. And that's the program in a nutshell, is looking at that type of thing. Usually it ends with a very extensive relapse prevention plan that looks at what their triggers are or what the needs were that weren't being met, what were the precursors to those, so what started it, what were the triggers, and we look at triggers from an emotional level, a behavioral level, a thought level, and a behavioral level. And we look at those factors, and then we write escape plans so that if I'm in the middle of a trigger, so let's say anger is a trigger for somebody who's going to commit a sex crime. If I'm in the middle of anger, how do I escape that anger? What do I do to get away from that to keep myself and another person safe? So we start developing escape plans around that, and then we do the same thing with avoidance plans, so that when I see these things coming, there are things I can do to avoid that from happening. And then on top of that, I always have people write long-term plans, what major goals, things that they can accomplish within 5 years, give them something to strive for, to achieve, something that's going to be tangible in their life that makes a difference.
So are you seeing many of these clients of yours while they are incarcerated, or have they already been?
Everybody that I see has either been incarcerated in jail or have been incarcerated in prison and are now released on parole.
Okay, so you're not actually seeing them in prison or jail. They're actually
correct.
Coming directly to
they are actually
office.
Living in the community at this point in time.
Okay, so explain that to us in a sense of how often usually have these people spent in incarcerated. Now we're looking at obviously being a registered sex offender. Maybe explain to us how that system works. And because, you know, we hear these stories as far as in the media that a sex offender can be anybody from, you know, a rapist of children to, you know, an 18-year-old boy who was having sex with his 16-year-old girlfriend, right? And so how do we even make sense of that type of list, serve, that we're going to be looking at? And just kind of give us a general overview of how that system works.
I wish there was an easy answer to tell you how to make sense of that. There is not an easy answer. Every state system is a little bit different. So how they classify people is a little bit different. Who gets registered is a little bit different in every single state in the nation. They try to do that based on the severity of the crime. Unfortunately, lots of states look at the conviction rather than the severity. So, as an example, a few years back, I had a man walk into the clinic, convicted of a low-level sex crime in the state. And he went to prison, came out on parole. He's placed on the sex offender registry at the very lowest level of sex offender registry. So he only has to register minimally, has to show up once a year to verify who he is. His crime involved stalking, breaking and entering on multiple occasions the same victim. When I talked to him, it was a crime built out of fantasy that he had had for a very long time about, if I break into a woman's house and I have sex with her, she will fall in love with me. How dangerous is he? He is probably more dangerous than what the sex offender registry has him listed at, because he has a compulsion, he has a fantasy, and this is something that happened on multiple occasions where he's breaking in on the same victim. Mm-hmm. You compare that to a man who just lost his wife within the last year. He has her daughter from a previous relationship who is 15 years old, who's doing all the caretaking, and one night he's drunk, he puts his hands on her in a way that's inappropriate. There was never really any sexual intercourse, but he has now been convicted of a crime, and he's at the top tier of registry, and the likelihood of him committing another crime like that probably is going to be fairly low for a number of factors. It wasn't fantasy driven. It was a one-time offense. He has a very good understanding of what he did. He has plenty of remorse about it. And it happened within a familial setting. And we know that those people tend to have less likelihood of reoffense once they've been caught and convicted.
Interesting. So, in other words, this registry system is confusing, not very maybe helpful in the sense of gauging the risk of different people in
our
community.
It's very confusing because it does not gauge risk at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to really do a good estimate of what the risk is going to be for an individual just looking at the registry. Risk assessment is very complicated and involves a number of other factors.
Can you talk about some of those factors? Well, I mean, you've talked about a few of them. You've talked about, you know, if they're looking at pornography or as you go through an assessment list, what are some of those factors that you look for?
Instability, problems with relationships, drug and alcohol use, level of fantasy, whether somebody is sexually attracted to boys or girls, because we know that if somebody's sexually attracted to boys, there is a slightly higher risk level with that for reoffense.
And are you talking about minor children? Or are you talking about like homosexual
yes.
attraction?
No, okay. This is not.
So this is from a pedophile perspective.
Mm-hmm. This is from a child molestation or pedophile mm-hmm. perspective, and there's a difference between those two categories.
Okay. So if you're attracted to boys, to male children, then mm-hmm. your likelihood is higher. Is that
there's a higher likelihood of reoffense in that case? Yes.
I see.
And very interesting is the men who sexually abuse boys, if you ever ask them and you sit down and talk to them about their own sexuality and their own sexual preference, they will 100% tell you, or I shouldn't say 100%, but most of the time they're going to tell you that they do not espouse themselves as being homosexual. That is not what this is about. Especially around pedophilia. I try to describe pedophilia in the same way that I describe any other type of sexuality orientation. People who are heterosexual are attracted to those who are the opposite sex. People who are homosexual are attracted to those who are attracted to the same sex. Pedophilia is the person who is sexually attracted to a child. Its brain, it's hardwired, it doesn't change. You can't make somebody who's heterosexual homosexual. You can't make somebody who's homosexual heterosexual. You can't make somebody who's pedophilic not pedophilic. It's really a hardwired process.
So I'm sure that's creating somewhat of, I mean, that creates some fear, obviously, if that's not something that can be changed, right? How do then we assess for risk management? And how often do you see that, for example, somebody who is sexually attracted to children can also be sexually attracted to adults? Or, you know, because with homosexuality and heterosexuality, obviously, that's a gender orientation, right? Mm-hmm. But is there a possibility that a pedophile could be still attracted to adults as well as that? Or do we see more that once you're a pedophile?
There's always the possibility. There's always the possibility. But the reality usually is if a true pedophile gets in a relationship with an adult, they're using the adult to get to the children. So it's a secondary relationship for their own purposes.
Is this
because
how
children
aren't
really that accessible to pedophiles otherwise. It's really difficult.
And is this the category that you would use to, I mean, we know that there's a lot of sexual inappropriateness or sexual abuse happening within, like, secondary marriages, so within stepchildren and stepparents, right? So mm-hmm. is that something you would say, well, people marry people with children to have access to children, or is that more of a familial kind of...
Is the guy... or the man who's going to marry a woman with children, and when you watch him, almost all of his interaction is with the children. You don't see much interaction with the woman that he's marrying. You see that he spends most of his time with the children. He heaps on praise, gifts, a lot of what we call grooming behavior to get everybody comfortable so that he can gain access. It's very difficult to see it as a layperson oftentimes because he seems like a really, really nice guy.
Well, yeah, that's scary. You're thinking, you know, as a mom of children that is looking for a father figure to step in. I mean, that's kind of what you're looking for, right? As somebody who will get along with your kids. And
But this is the guy who gets along too well with your kids.
Because there's obviously a lot of good stepfathers out there that we don't want to put into.
Yeah. And fortunately, pedophilia is very, very rare. It's not something that we see a lot of. You figure that somewhere maybe around 1, maybe 2% of the population is pedophilic. So it's not something you're going to run across.
Yeah, so let's talk about the definition of pedophilic. Because, like, for instance, what's the difference of somebody being attracted to a 6-year-old child versus maybe a 14-year-old teenager who is still a minor?
Pedophilia is really about sexual attraction to a child before they hit puberty, or have characteristics of puberty beginning. Once that happens, once puberty, there's an onset of puberty, then we can't talk about pedophilia anymore. From a technical term, it becomes hebephilia, which is the sexual attraction to basically adolescents. Whole other controversy around all of that. But pedophilia is really that point in time from birth to whenever the onset starts for puberty, whether it's 10, 11, 12, 13, whatever it happens to be for that particular child.
So where the child obviously still has physical childlike attributes.
Right. And that's really the attraction for the pedophilia. The pedophilic man, that's what they're looking for. Once they start seeing secondary sexual signs, they're not that interested. They really want that before those characteristics show up.
Okay, so just to kind of, you know, just to throw out there, I mean, these are, I think, are all very, very helpful definitions, but just to throw out there, like, for instance, some of the people that I've worked through some traumas, especially those that I feel like have been abused by their own biological fathers. Mm-hmm. I've had several clients where they really report abuse from pre-adolescence onto their adolescence. And ongoing. So this wasn't like it stopped when they, you know, when they turned 13. So can you speak to that factor?
I wouldn't necessarily call them pedophilic at that point in time. Obviously, some of the behavior looks that way. But these guys usually are very self-absorbed, very narcissistic. They are power and control hungry. They dominate all aspects of the family so that they can get what they need, or what they desire in this case. And it really doesn't matter because I have easy access to everybody in the house.
Okay. So at that point, it's more about getting their needs met than maybe what they're actually attracted to, is kind of what you're saying?
It's about what they need and want. Correct.
Okay, I know that there's been some DSM change. Since we're talking about pedophilia, there's been some changes in the new DSM-5 that just came out this past year. Are you able to talk about that and whether or not those are significant?
The changes in DSM-5 are not that significant. They're not that big. They're just trying to kind of differentiate between behavior and kind of thought patterns, and whether that makes a difference or not. There's some controversy on. I don't think anybody's been real happy with the diagnostic code for that, or what changes were not made, depending on who you're talking to. But the reality is, when you're doing diagnosis, there's not a lot of difference. It looks very much the same. It feels very much the same. And the criteria, except for two pretty minor things, is basically the same that we've seen. So, in my opinion, it's not enough to even do much thought about, because we know what pedophilia is at this point, and the diagnostic criteria is pretty minor as far as a change goes.
Okay. I was under the impression that it might have some legal implication in the sense of, you know, the DSM-5 is used not only by psychotherapists, but by lawyers, you know, as far as getting mm-hmm. kind of convictions tried. And so there was, I thought, some difference as to whether or not you have thoughts, pedophilic thoughts, and not just pedophilia. There's other philias, right? There's other
right.
Things that are out there for people, but versus having the behavior. But then, of course, at what point, you know, is the thought going to, you know, precursor to the behavior, and then you're
right.
leaving people at risk. So these are some of the, I think, the controversies that have come up in the field.
But the reality is, when you're doing conviction off of behavior, not doing it off of thought. You have to have a behavior in order to even get investigated at this point. There is some interesting stuff around internet crime and what this means about internet crime. That's a whole other topic. and what this may mean for sting operations that we see on internet, and what they're going to... the argument becomes is, did I still engage in behavior that was luring a child? And if the answer is yes, then from kind of a very basic legal perspective, they're still going to say, okay, we have behavior.
Well, and how does this play out? Because I've also worked with several clients who have been involved with child pornography, or that's how they at least present. But oftentimes when I'm out, at least the clients I have worked with, and again, this is not my area of expertise and I refer out, but this is what's brought to my office, is, you know, that they were watching pornography or downloading pornography that had minors, but again, adolescents. So I have not, at least in my office yet, had somebody who was involved in what I would call, I mean, maybe guess, you know, quote unquote, true child pornography. So is there a distinction legally in that sense, or is that treated the same?
The federal standard is that you cannot have sexual imagery of anybody under 18 years of age. That's child pornography. There's varying degrees to that from the federal standard, and it makes it very easy from a law enforcement perspective to go after it that way. Each of the states is very much modeled after what the federal standard is at this point in time. So whether somebody has or does not have child pornography basically is, if the images exist and it is on your computer, you're going to find the full wrath of the legal system come down upon you, because it's very easy to prosecute. I've got all the evidence in front of me. You know, once it's on the computer, it's there. I can recover it. It's not a difficult process at that point in time. And just a single image is all it takes. So if you are downloading anything, you have to be very careful about what you're downloading. File sharing becomes problematic because you don't, for a lot of people, they don't even see what they're downloading when they're doing file sharing. They just set up their computer to run a file share program, download whatever captures with whatever keywords are out there, and then boom, you've got stuff. Peer-to-peer networks tend to be the same way with that. All of a sudden, you have a great deal of imagery that you didn't even realize you had, but you are in possession of it. And that's all it really takes, unfortunately.
Yes, and in this kind of new world of navigating the internet, there's some things that I guess people need to be aware of, correct? And
correct.
I guess I would even go further with adolescents. I mean, again, I'm not sure how much to put on this because I'm not very involved with these types of cases, but I've heard of like adolescents, teenagers who are sexting to one another and sending pictures of one another,
yes.
And that can fall under the child pornography laws because...
Not
minors.
Only can, it does.
Okay, so can you explain that a little bit, and let's kind of educate our teens as to what not to do, please?
Basically, don't take nude pictures. Very, very simple.
Yes.
because if you take a nude picture of your girlfriend, of your boyfriend, now you have possession of child pornography if you're under 18, if that person is under 18. And it doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what age you are, the way the legal system looks at it is you have the image. The minute you send that to your friend, you now can be convicted of distributing child pornography, which is a whole other level of charges.
Goodness
that
grief.
Are extremely serious. And the more that you send, the more charges you can have. So the easy way out of this is don't take photos of people who are naked. Don't take photos of sexual activity. Don't take video of any of that stuff, because as long as the person is under 18, you're going to be in a great deal of trouble from a legal perspective.
And this also applies if you're taking them of yourself. Like a 14-year-old child taking a picture of themselves, it doesn't matter.
If I do a selfie of my genitalia and I'm sending it out to my girlfriend who's also 14, too bad. I've just basically committed child pornography on myself.
Well, and the real horror
stories... There's a lot of controversy about that, but...
Yeah. And the real horror stories that I hear is if they're taking these pictures and downloading them to their family computers or their own computers... But now this computer is in the home. Are the adults, mm-hmm. are the parents responsible for that content? And can they be charged with having access to child pornography?
That depends on the prosecutor, unfortunately. There are some prosecutors who are very, very aggressive about that. There are other prosecutors who are very understanding about that. So it really depends on your local prosecutor what happens with that. They may just go after the child. They may go after everybody. But prosecutors are... very unpredictable from county to county how they're going to enforce that piece of it. So it's really about knowing your own prosecutor.
So it sounds like, I mean, obviously I talk about sexual education a lot with my audience, and this is obviously a big piece of our sexual education that we need to be talking to our teens about, having very frank discussions about what internet safety and sexual safety on the internet is all about.
Yes, very much.
Okay. So going back to the program that you were describing as far as, you know, having this empathetic approach, seeing, you know, treating the offender courteously, and then moving on to responsibility and admittance and relapse prevention plans. Tell us a little bit about how that's worked out. I mean, how do you measure success in this process that you've been involved with?
The easy way to measure success, and really kind of the only way, is we look at reoffense levels or rearrest levels, actually. It's hard to tell if people actually are reoffending or not if they're not arrested for it. So we look at rearrest records and how often people get rearrested for similar type of crime. In theory, you should have kind of like a 10% failure rate. 10% of your clients should be reoffending in theory, because it's a tough population. The best tracking we've been able to do, which by no means is perfect, is out of the hundreds and hundreds of men who have actually successfully completed the treatment program, we're averaging under 20 people who have been re-arrested, reconvicted for new sex crimes, which is really, really low. The other thing that's kind of unique for me is that throughout the years, I have a number of men who have been through the program who show up at my doorstep on random just to walk in and say hi, tell me how things are going. And it doesn't matter whether they finished the program 3 months ago or they finished the program 16 years ago, they still show up, they still call me, they still tell me what's going on. They say to me, you know, I was having this discussion with my buddy the other day, and this thing came up, and it reminded me of my relapse prevention plan, and I got it out and looked at it and went, oh, yeah, this is a danger zone for me. I have to do. And that meant I had to call you. So it's kind of a unique experience for me, because when I talk to other people who treat offenders, I don't hear about this re-engagement with their clients who continue to come back to them, who continue to talk to them. That may be because I'm very open about it, and I've always told my clients, at any point, if anything happens, there is a difficulty, call me. I'll talk to you. If it's real important, we'll get together, we'll do it face to face. But more importantly, if you want to tell me your successes, I love to hear them. I want to celebrate success with you. And yeah. I think that makes a huge difference for offenders, but also people in general, to know that somebody is on your side. Somebody really, truly cares that you be successful, that you make your life what it is, that you can make it in a way that is healthy, pro-social, and as a benefit not only to yourself but to society at a greater level.
Yeah, no, that's really wonderful. I mean, in essence, you're talking about what we know as therapists is a huge factor towards any type of success, is that of joining and having a good bond with our clients, right? So sounds like that's a talent of yours. And is your program similar to other sex offender programs, or is it pretty unique? Some.
It's similar to some, unique to others. I wish I could say there is a one single standard in sex offender treatment, but there isn't. Every treatment program looks a bit different. I've very much tried to model mine after the best current research there is. I've thrown stuff out that we've used. I've taken new stuff in. I continually have tweaked this program over the years because I want it to be the best program that I can do with these men that walk in the door. But unfortunately, not every program is like that. There are other programs who don't work in this cognitive model, this cognitive behavioral model that I tend to work out of. They work in a more psychodynamic model. So the man comes in, they sit around, they talk for an hour and then, or 2 hours, and they send the guy home. And, well, okay, that was nice. There's no homework in between. There's nothing they have to do in between. And you see success drop at that point in time because there's no motivation to make change. And it's really about how do you motivate these men to make change.
Yeah. So are you offering trainings, or have you done anything formal to kind of get your type of program out there, since you have had such a high rate of success?
I've done a little bit of training here and there.
Yeah.
It's not something I've had a lot of time to do because up until very recently, we had very, very large numbers of people going through the program, and it took a lot of time. An average intake is 4 to 5 hours per person.
Wow. And how are these? So these are, you're contracted by the state or something? In other words, I mean, these people are obviously not usually paying out of pocket to get these services. Is this
correct?
Covered by insurance at all, or is it?
Forensic treatment is not covered by insurance. It is either you're going to pay for it yourself, or the state's going to pay for it in some way.
And I'm assuming that when the state mandates it, if the client isn't able to pay, they're paying for it.
Correct.
Okay, very interesting. So even though these are diagnosable issues, once it becomes forensic treatment, it's not insurance reimbursable.
Correct.
Okay. I'm planning on moving on to kind of how we manage this as a community, or those of us, you know, kind of, especially since we're talking to kind of a Mormon audience here, you know, where do we go from here? Before I go there, is there anything about kind of the setup or the explanation that I'm not asking you about that you'd like to clarify or talk about?
I don't think so.
Okay. So I'm going to start with this empathy piece. because I think that this is a very important piece to discuss, and maybe how you manage it personally, or how, you know, what are the issues? Because obviously, when there's been an act of violence or an assault of any type, more than likely, the empathy is going to go to the victim, as it probably should.
Absolutely, it should.
Right. So as we deal with this, either as victims or as a community at large trying to support victims, how do we manage this piece about empathy, and how important is that, especially in a religious community where this is very complicated, right? Because we have all these messages of forgiveness and turn the other cheek and et cetera, et cetera. In fact, sometimes that becomes a real problem for victims because they're mm-hmm. continuing to allow the perpetrator in their life and under this guise of forgiveness. So I work a lot more on the other side of this, right, with the trauma. Right. And so I'm constantly helping clients decide what forgiveness is going to look like and that boundaries have nothing to do with forgiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So let me just let you loose a little bit on this topic.
The easy way to say this is forgive, but don't forget. If you want to forgive, that you have that right. It's not something that you absolutely have to do, I don't think, for people who have committed these type of horrific acts. I never have an offender ask for forgiveness from a victim, because I don't think the victim has to give them forgiveness if they're not ready to do that. So, having said that, offenders go through difficulties in their own lives that lead them to where they are at. And having empathy for an offender means that you understand that they have difficulties, you understand that they are struggling, you understand that this is a process for them, but you don't forget that they committed a heinous act on another person. So you treat them with respect, you treat them with empathy, but you also always have a sense of caution in the back of your head. Creating safety, creating safe zones for people. When I have an offender who wants to be reintroduced to a religious community, the first thing that I want them to do is to go to the religious leaders or the leadership board and present themselves to those people. Talk about what they've done, what they've been through, and that there is a need to set up boundaries and safety within the church so that this person is not going to be alone with whatever their target was of their crime. So if their target was children, for example, you don't want them running choir or daycare, Sunday school, those type of things, because it just kind of puts them in a danger zone that is not worthwhile for anybody. So maybe that person is sitting right up front during services with other adults, so they're not in the back hanging out with the teenagers. Maybe they're escorted into the facility and escorted out after services are over by a member of the leadership of the congregation. It is about creating safe zones for these individuals so that they can still worship, they can still receive the benefits of their faith, but do it in a way that is safe and appropriate for everybody.
So this what you're stating requires a lot of transparency, obviously, from the perpetrator, that he or she is willing to be very transparent to the community at large. Yes. And which, of course, you know, for me, just kind of brings up the question of, you know, are we re-shaming this individual? And maybe we are, and maybe that's okay because it's part of the consequence of the action that happened. Or maybe it's empowering because the person is taking responsibility for their action. I mean, how would you?
I think one is empowering because the person takes responsibility. Two, I don't think we're going to tell every single person in the congregation that, okay, Joe here is our sex offender, so we're treating him X way or Y way. What this is really something that's held in confidence with the leadership, so that they know, what to look for if there's ever a problem. But not everybody in the congregation needs to know. Not everybody who attends needs to know. It's really only the important people that need to know this, really as a safety measure for everybody, as much for the offender as it is for everybody else. And
why? Why is that? Why would it be safe to not let everybody know if for both parties?
Well, one becomes the shaming issue because you don't want to re-shame people if you don't have to, especially if it's somebody who has worked very, very hard at putting this behind them or managing it in a way that they've done very, very well for a long period of time. Let's say that you have somebody who committed a sex offense 9 years ago. Do they need to relive that every time they walk into church? And my answer is absolutely not. They don't need to. It happened 9 years ago. Nothing else has happened since then. The likelihood of something else happening is almost non-existent at that point also. Some of the new research out there is looking at time frames for reoffending and is very suggestive that if somebody can make it to 10 years without reoffending, their chances of reoffending becomes almost zero.
That's interesting.
So it's kind of preliminary research. We need to get some more data with that at this point in time, but it's very interesting research because we haven't seen that type of thing yet. But anecdotally, we're also seeing that very much with offenders that we see on a daily basis, that if they can make it through that 10-year period without an offense, then the likelihood of a new offense becomes very limited or very, very low. The most dangerous time is within the first 2 years. So if I have an offender coming to church within the first 2 years, I want to set up even higher parameters with kind of safety stuff so that they're not hanging out with kids, for example, if kids are what their problem is, or they're not running games or, you know, flirting with every good-looking woman who's walking into church, because that may be a problem as well for that person. So it depends on what the offender is. But allowing them to have the opportunity to worship, if there are men's religious groups, allowing them to attend those because they're very beneficial at that point in time, or for women to attend women's groups. Because as you talk to offenders, or guys, I've talked to offenders, they really want to get back to the religious community in some way. It becomes very important to them as part of their recovery. But they need to do it in a way that they understand is going to keep everybody safe, which includes them, because they don't want to have another victim.
Right. So, well, it's very interesting you start talking about this, because this is exactly the question that came up for me on my blog that I've never actually answered. So this will be my answer, is posting this interview. But there was a congregation where this happened, where a registered sex offender, you know, was, I think the way it was is, and let me, you know, if you need me to clarify any of these Mormon terms, let me know. But they were basically a member of the church, and they had offended at some point. And so then, because he was still a member of the church and on our records, at some point, you know, we're very good in our church of keeping track of people and trying to reactivate them. And so somebody had tracked into his home and basically said, hey, why aren't you coming to church? And, you know, are you interested in returning? And this is when this information came to light for the, I guess, ward boundaries, that this person was a sex offender and therefore they were inviting him back to church, which, I mean, very much goes along with Christian values, right? We go after the black sheep. We go after the lost, you know, one out of the hundred. Yes. We are forgiving. We believe in redemption. We believe in salvation for all, you know, as long as there's repentance and appropriate, you know, furthering in that sense. So all of that, you know, ties into our Mormon and Christian values. But when this was presented as part of the ward council, there were obviously concerns brought up. And I think the bishop and the bishopric, you know, wanted to be transparent to the ward council and tell them what was happening and, you know, kind of come up with a plan kind of similar to some of the suggestions that you made. But then there were people that kind of had a zero tolerance policy for this. And I think what ended up happening in this ward is that a good amount of the congregation ended up leaving for another congregation, which actually in our culture is not something that happens very easily because mm-hmm. we're geographically kind of, kind of encouraged, if not mandated, to kind of attend certain geographical, you know, wards. So this became a real kind of, you know, problem for this ward as a whole. And one of the things that you brought up that was interesting was this confidentiality piece, which I think is much harder in Mormon congregations because there are these councils and these leaders that are temporary and they change, you know, over time. And we don't have necessarily a pastor who's going to be the pastor for the next 20 years per se. Right. So,
well, leadership in all churches, confidentiality among leadership so that we don't talk about this, even if we're no longer on the council or member of the board or whatever it may be. So it becomes kind of a negotiation piece that you have to work within your own leadership council about how to maintain that type of confidentiality while still being respectful that, yeah, we know that there might be a problem here, but we have to do this in a way that respects everybody.
Confidentiality piece, I'm sure, becomes even more complicated if somebody in the ward council, for example, says, well, but this is a sexual, you know, a registered sex offender, and that's public knowledge. So why do I have to keep that confidential?
Yeah. And then you kind of go back to this idea of talking about forgiveness and about bringing somebody back to their faith. And what does it take to bring somebody back to faith? It doesn't take shaming them again, even though it may be public knowledge that this guy's a sex offender. We still want him to be able to practice his faith, to be closer to God, to have the ability to worship without us making the judgment, because it's not our place to judge.
Yeah, so would it be fair to kind of even present maybe some, you know, because I'm hoping people who are listening, you know, many of them are in leadership positions, and so if they ever find themselves in this kind of spot, that this would serve as somewhat of a resource for them, or even if they're just members of a congregation where something like this is happening. And so is it okay to say, you know, if you've been a victim, obviously, of sexual assault, or if you're, you know, idea of safety is compromised by having some type of sex offender move into your ward, and you have that knowledge, and you then make the decision to create the boundary for yourself and to move out of that ward, is that a reasonable boundary to create?
Absolutely.
So that's one side of the story. And then also kind of if you're the bishop or stake president or, you know, people in those types of decision mm-hmm. roles, that it's okay to then support those types of boundaries for certain members at the same time trying to navigate this reunification of the perpetrator with their faith worship.
I think there's lots of room for boundaries, and we have to establish boundaries that are appropriate for individuals. If we have an individual who has been abused, who has some other type of difficulty with an offender coming in to worship, it's very appropriate to support them to do what they need to do in order to create the safety for themselves. And if that means moving to a different ward, we should be able to support them in that while still supporting the offender who's coming in to worship as well. Because it's really about continuing to receive the blessing from God, to worship, to be able to achieve that connection with God in ways that we all seek all the time. And if I'm not feeling safe, then I need to be supportive of that person who's not safe, to be able to move, to be able to establish whatever boundaries that are there for that person to maintain safety, while at the same time still allowing or finding a way for this former offender to come in and also worship, and trying to figure out how to be supportive of both is, I think, very important, just from an aspect of faith, an aspect of what we are here to believe in.
Yeah, and you can see how complicated it is, right, to seek for the needs of both parties in this type of scenario. So I think you've given some really good examples, though, of things that could possibly be negotiated, especially between the leadership and the perpetrator. You mentioned, you know, having a certain spot where the perpetrator sits. Maybe if the perpetrator needs to use the restroom, which is a public restroom, somebody accompanies them to that. Or in our culture, we have callings, right? And so everybody generally has a job to do. And so making sure that a calling that is given is an appropriate one, in the sense of not placing that person into high risk populations, right? Such as children or women or whatever that may be. So yeah, do you have any other suggestions, or are those are all good ones?
Those are starting points. And then it becomes the nuances of what's going on for that individual who's walking in. Because you really have to sit down and talk with them about what is risky for them, what their needs are to be safe, so that you can figure out how to keep everybody safe and how to create an environment that is inviting to worship for everybody. But you need a starting point with kind of just basic boundaries of, how do I bring this person in? How do I get them back out? Do I give them free access to everything in the building, or do I always have somebody accompany them? And the offenders who I've worked with this way have been very appreciative of having a mentor, if we will, of the church with them all the time to help bring them back into the community. And really, I think is the most productive way for people who have committed offenses to come back into the fold, is to give them a mentor, somebody that they can talk to, somebody that they can rely on, who is going to be supportive of them, as well as understand that, okay, if I see this, I need to call it to their attention. If I see the other thing, I need to do something else about this. And not to be afraid of going to the bishop if there's a major problem, or not being afraid of confronting the former offender if there's a minor problem, but being there as a supportive guy to say, you know, you need to do this or that, or, you know, we need to bring this to somebody else, like the bishop, and talk about what is the next best move for us.
So another aspect of Mormon culture is that we have lay leadership, right? So these are not, you know, our bishops and people who are serving in leadership positions are not necessarily trained in mental health issues or things of that nature. And so I wonder, in your work, do you do much, do you reach out to ecclesiastical leaders in some of these cases, or do people sign kind of releases of information to be able to speak with, to have you speak with their leaders?
Yes. It's very, very possible. It happens all the time.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we'd probably recommend, right? Is if this offender is working with some type of therapist or mental health professional, that'd be good to be in touch with that, with that professional, as far as guidance and understanding of the issues at large.
Absolutely.
So looking at this kind of maybe from a preventative measure or kind of a larger cultural sense, here, and again, in Mormon culture, we've had a lot of recent talk about patriarchy, about gender roles. There was a recent talk that kind of drew some attention. Granted, I was part of that problem of drawing attention to it. That was, I thought, very problematic in the way that we were approaching morality and modesty and somewhat, you know, rape culture-ish, you know, like in a sense kind of putting some of the, I think, unintended blame on women for these kinds of issues, you know, how they dress and how they conduct themselves being part of the problem. So I find that type of language very problematic. We do know that Mormonism still very much is a patriarchy, and I think oftentimes that's seen as a protective measure, but oftentimes I think it creates a lot of problems for those in communities where, you know, men preside, and men not only in church leaderships, but in their homes. And so, you know, obviously if you've got a healthy family functioning and the man knows how to really give equal opportunity to his wife and the wife knows how to be part of that, that can work well for a lot of Mormon families. But where there is some of this family dysfunction or potential for family sexual abuse, this patriarchal type of issue can be quite problematic. So I guess I'd like some of your thoughts about religion in general, culture in general.
God created man and women to be partners, not for one to be dominant over the other, but for them to work together towards a common goal. When that gets skewed and the man becomes more dominant or more aggressive, we know that aggression leads to violence for men in many situations. The biggest thing we can do is to not be afraid to report abuse, not be afraid to report when things are problematic, to support those who are victims while helping those who are perpetrators, to be able to bring balance back to the union. The process is difficult. The time is intense to do that. But I think it's also critical that we do that when there is problems, that we don't gloss them over, we don't set them aside, that we actually bring them to the front, seek help, not only from professionals, but also from our community, from our religious community in particular, because the union is to the glory of the Creator. That's what we were here for. So coming up with this cooperative ability to function together, understanding that we both have certain roles that we have to fulfill in a family. What those roles are can be negotiated. They can be more dominant for one, less dominant for another. But to still achieve balance becomes the kind of the critical thing here. Because when things get out of balance is when offenders that I've seen tend to create their offenses. When there's too much of something or too little of something for them. So bringing them back into balance becomes kind of the critical aspect in family life or in relationships.
So how do we as a Mormon community go about giving this very, you know, good message that you're stating here? How do we teach and how do we give these types of messages, especially in a culture where gender is very important and gender roles seem to be very prominent? Mm-hmm. How do we start addressing this better in our communities?
I don't think I have an easy answer for you.
No, that makes sense. I don't have an easy answer either. Any ideas?
I think it's just opening up the discussion. Both from a religious aspect as well as from a cultural aspect about culture changes. We're not the same we were 10 years ago culturally. We're not the same we were 50 years ago culturally. Culture changes. How do we move with the changes while maintaining our faith. And just having that discussion, beginning that discussion becomes, I think, the critical point, rather than continuing to push it away. It's really about opening up discussion about all the topics and saying, we need to talk about this more. We need to address this more. We need to look at this more. Instead of running away from it because we're scared that it might create a change. When you look at it, every great religious leader created a change. And without them, we'd be still sitting way back there somewhere in our faith than where we're sitting today.
Yeah, so not be afraid of change, even if that means some, I guess, redefinition of gender and how that plays a role in our church, which mm-hmm. I think is very family-oriented. So obviously we, I think, try to honor mothers and fathers and their roles. At the same time, it's important to be open maybe to how some of those things can become problematic, especially mm-hmm. in certain family systems, especially if they're patriarchal in nature. Is that, would those be fair?
Yeah.
Things to say. Okay.
Yes.
No, that's wonderfully said. And I really appreciate you kind of delving into some of that spiritual language with us. I know you come from some similar, you know, cultural things yourself. So I can't thank you enough for this very wonderful, interview and the time that you've spent with us. Time is always so valuable. So this is just, I just can't thank you enough. Is there any lasting thoughts that you want to leave us with or anything I haven't asked you that you think is important, or have we covered this well?
The only lasting thought I would say is treat each other with respect, no matter what your background is.
Yeah, that's well said. Well, thank you for those who have listened. I hope this has been helpful. I hope that this can be helpful for many different people in many different circumstances, whether you're a leader, whether you're a perpetrator, whether you're a victim, whether you're a general ward member and needing information of this sort. I think it's so applicable really to any of us, as this is really kind of a national issue that we have and an international issue. As John Wells stated, this type of issue knows no societal or economic realm. Thank you for supporting the podcast. If you can do so, that would be wonderful. We're really trying to move forward with some bigger kind of visions for Mormon mental health and some of the roles that it can play for those of you who need it to play bigger roles. And just again, thank you for your time. And if you want to make comments under the comment section of the post, we really would appreciate hearing from you. Thanks again, John, and we will see you soon at the next conference.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee, Jesus saved.